tea and coffee up at Suite 8 for the programs as a social event. So I think you're going to start with
you, right. I started this subject entirely by accident in 1991 when I wrote a small piece of journalism, which was not because I had any interest in kidney sales in particular, but just because we'd had our great scandal erupt and every single argument in the public debate was just awful and nobody seemed to notice. So I wrote a little piece. And I've never been allowed to drop the subject since. It was picked up by doctors, and there are some people who think I do nothing else except talk about organ sales anyway. And a year ago, I was just telling my fellow contributor, I was hoiked off to the Philippines to talk at a policy-making thing that they were doing there. So this subject is still simmering, and I sort of do it on a back burner. It's a highly emotive subject. When it first came up in Britain, it had been discovered that Turkish peasants were coming. Turkish peasants were coming over to the country to sell their organs, and everybody was horrified. And they rushed to pass all kinds of legislation, and I think it's the quickest legislation we've ever had apart from the Dangerous Dogs Act. In fact, it may even have been quicker than the Dangerous Dogs Act. It was Mrs. Thatcher, and she rushed to say how we should cancel this stuff immediately. And the doctors who'd been participating, even though there were no laws against it at the time, were presumed to have done something so obviously wrong that they were threatened with being struck off and all the rest of it. And then the Transplant Society, the professional body, rushed in and pronounced their anathema. So everybody started agreeing that this wouldn't do. And the newspapers were full of stuff about the greedy rich who were now taking even the bodies of those who had nothing else left to sell. Anyone would think they were putting them in display cases and such. And the poor, exploited poor who had nothing else to sell except themselves. And this certainly sounded very persuasive. But it was very clear from the speed of reaction, there was no time for anyone to think, is this a sensible thing? What about the pros and cons? It was just instantaneous, fueled by feeling. And to quote from Mill again, I was quoting from Mill last time I was doing this, he said that when it's a result of feeling, you've got a particularly difficult job arguing, he says, because if the opinion were the result of reason, then the refutation of the reasons might dislodge the opinion. But when it is rooted in feeling, then the worse it fares in argumentative context, the more persuaded its adherents are that their feeling must have some deeper ground which the arguments do not reach. And while the feeling remains, it is always throwing up fresh entrenchments of argument to repair any breach in the old. And that's just what happens here. And as soon as you start arguing about this, you say one thing and then somebody will leap up from over there saying, oh, but, and then another, oh, but. So the real challenge in this area is to try and keep the arguments in order of some sort. So, starting at the beginning, in this sort of context, I don't think there's the slightest point in saying, well, your moral principles are all absurd, I'm going to defend mine, and so on. So I think the best kind of argument is structured ad hominem in the good sense. That is, you use your opponent's own premises and presuppositions to start supporting your conclusion. So let's start at the beginning then with the greedy rich. Now, the greedy rich in this context are merely people who are trying to save their own lives, or at least to get off dialysis, which is no fun. Now, most of us, if we thought we were threatened with immediate death, would probably spend all the money we had to try and keep ourselves alive. And you don't have to be very rich to want to do that. And in many parts of the world, there isn't any dialysis. So unless you think the lives of the rich are worth nothing, you should think there's a presumption in favour of getting transplant organs, even for the rich, you know, people who are a lot less rich than us, but even for the rich. So, most people who are... How does this work?
Can you just click again?
Oh, click.
Yes, every time you click something.
Oh, right. Right. So let's say that anybody involved in this debate who isn't totally against transplants altogether is going to say that they're going to agree that there's a presumption in favour of any policy that will get more organs and save more lives. Now, of course, it's only a presumption. It's just saying this is intrinsically the case, but of course it might be defeated. Now then, the exploited poor. One of the people in this original debate was a Turkish peasant who'd come over to sell his kidney because he was trying to buy treatment for his daughter who was dying of leukemia. So we, the concerned rich, are rushing in to persuade him to save, or to try and save him from himself by saying, we won't let you sell your organ, you can go home and watch your daughter die of leukemia. Strange way to show consideration for people that you regard as poor and having very few choices open to them. You actually take away the best choice they've got and send them off to have a worse one. And the worse you think it is to lose a kidney, the worse you must think the choice you're sending them back to. Right, this is the second presumption. By most people's standards, we should increase the options for the badly off, not decrease them, if that's our concern. And that's essentially what being badly off is. You've got very few options. And there's also a third point, which comes out of our standard ideas about autonomy, that we think that consenting adults should be allowed to make arrangements among themselves which don't hurt anybody else. Here are two people wanting to make a mutually beneficial exchange. One wants the kidney, the other wants the money. So there's a presumption by all our normal standards for saying you allow mutually beneficial or mutually desired, I've put so as not to beg questions, private exchanges. Now, all of those presumptions, I think, would be held by everyone in the debate. So there's nothing mysterious about that. There's nothing eccentric or sort of thing that comes out of the 21st century school. You know, this is just basic stuff. Right, now, so there's the beginning of the argument. Am I pressing the wrong thing? I'm not used to...
Left, right.
Oh. I'm used to a Mac.
Yeah.
Right, so now we've got to reach the argument conclusion. Therefore, kidney selling should be prohibited. And so far, the argument seems awfully as though it goes in the other direction. Which means that... Now, the point about this is it very clearly sets up a burden of proof. Anyone who's going to say kidney selling should be prohibited, which is the issue, is going to have to find a way to complete that argument, which has got all their own premises in, and come to the conclusion. Now, obviously, you do that by putting in a but. And you see, and the way you keep this argument in order is by systematically looking at the things which are inserted in the but part of the argument. And basically, there are two kinds of question you ask about each premise that's inserted. One is whether it's true. The other is whether, irrespective of whether it's true, it actually supports the conclusion. And it's quite astonishing what actually happens in these arguments. So, let's try an assortment of them. All these are actually in the field. Now, as Mill says, you can always produce fresh entrenchments of arguments. And there's obviously potentially infinite stuff that can be put under this but, so I don't take myself to have exhausted all possibilities. But having started this in 1991, I think I must have encountered quite a few by now. Anyway, here's one of the first ones that came up. There are various kinds of objection. Some of them are invoking principles which are supposed to override all these other considerations. Not that they're presented that way, because the people who argue don't have this starting point, that not explicitly. Some of them are just making other kinds of claims. So here's a statement of principle. The claim is that there's no genuine consent. That is, it amounts to an undercutting of this mutually desired private exchange. That is, one side at least hasn't really consented. And this is absolutely required. And there are several arguments underpinning this, and here's the first of them. This one is widely said. These poor, uneducated people, they don't dare say foreign or anything like that, these poor, uneducated people just don't understand enough to be able to be competent to consent. And competence is one of the legally required bases for valid consent. Well, various questions about this. To start with, competence legally is not a matter of how much you know, it's a matter of how capable you are of understanding. And we don't regard people as non-competent to consent just because they don't know enough already. We expect to inform them. We are not, as we stand, most of us, some of us are, competent to assess whether we should have an operation or not, but we expect to be given the information and allowed to consent. So it isn't a matter of knowledge, it's a matter of ability. Second, people in these relevant populations are frequently regarded as competent to consent to other kinds of operation, and in particular to kidney donation. There's scandals in some part of India that when a man wants a kidney, he'll go and get married and take the woman's kidney straight away. The woman is regarded as perfectly competent to consent to her kidney being taken. So in fact, there's no evidence for this, and indeed most people believe it's not true because they allow consent in other contexts. But even if it were, it doesn't support this conclusion. Because how can you get from a claim that a lot of the people who might want to consent to some procedure are not competent to the conclusion that the procedure should not be allowed at all? You could never administer drugs to demented people under those circumstances, for instance. Even if they were incompetent, some of them, obviously not all, because you get rich people offering their kidneys for enough money, even if some of them were not competent to consent, it still wouldn't imply that the whole procedure should be ruled out. It's just not a bit of reasoning that one uses in any other context. Right, so the second argument, this leads to some very interesting complexities which we can't go into, but the second one is the vendors are coerced by poverty, so their consent is not truly voluntary. Now, the second legal requirement for valid consent is voluntariness. And this is a particularly interesting one because all kinds of people play games with it, say your consent wasn't genuine here because it wasn't voluntary. The idea is that poverty is a coercion, and therefore they didn't choose to sell their organs, really. Now, there are various ways of doing this, and we can possibly discuss it. But the very least you've got to do, if you're saying that something doesn't come up to scratch because it's not voluntary, you need to give a criterion of voluntariness which you would accept. You can't just... And the danger here is that people are actually meaning by voluntary something you would regard as intrinsically desirable, something you would choose to do, left to itself. Now, people obviously don't want to get rid of their organs, but if you say that's not truly voluntary, the same thing applies to somebody who's giving their organs. They don't want to have their kidney taken out either. It's just that all things considered, they would rather lose one of their kidneys than have their friend or husband or whatever die. No threats found.
Something else that was running. No, no, it's computer's fault.
Is it? The point is, they are making a genuine choice among the options available. Now, clearly, sometimes when consent is coerced, you can overrule that. What typically happens is that somebody forces you into a particular consent that you don't want by holding a gun to your head. And then when you've got out of their power and no longer have the gun to your head, you would go to court and say, this was not truly voluntary, this was not genuine consent, and of course the court would agree. But the reason for that is that you're now out of that situation, no longer threatened, and the court is not willing to let the person who held the gun to your head benefit by it. But if you still had the gun held to your head, and somebody was saying, unless you consent, the gunman was saying, unless you consent, we'll have him holding the gun to your child's head, unless you give me the money, I will shoot your child, you wouldn't expect a well-wisher to come and hold you back from giving the money on the grounds that you hadn't truly consented because of the coercion. Of course you would be allowed to hand over the money, because that's the best situation that coercer has allowed. What you should, of course, be doing if you're worried about coercion is getting rid of the coercion so that the person has more choices again. That's what you do, ideally. You don't prevent the person who's being coerced from handing over the money. You try to get the gun away from the gunman. And, of course, that's the next mistake people hear, next mistake people make at this point, because they say, well, of course we should be lifting the poor out of poverty. We agree entirely that the way to remove coercion is to get the poor out of poverty. So here's the next claim. Fine, very nice premise. Nobody would object to the ethics of that premise. But again, how do you get from there to the conclusion? However hard you try to lift the poor out of poverty, if you succeed in making everybody so rich that they don't need to sell their organs or don't feel tempted to, then there would be no point in prohibiting kidney sales because nobody would want to do it. Conversely, if anybody does want to do it, and there is a point, sorry, if there is a point in selling kidneys, then that means that some people would rather have the money than the kidney, and therefore, Julian, you look too uncomfortable. So the point is, even if you accept that nice premise, it doesn't support the conclusion, because if people were not wanting to sell their kidneys, you wouldn't need any law to prevent them. This is a very common kind of mistaken argument that comes up. And going back again to the consent, this is really scratching the barrel. Some of the doctors were arguing that the consent, they hadn't really consented because they'd been coerced by unrefusable offers. If you offer a peasant thousands of dollars, or even $2,000, which is more than 5 years' income or whatever it is, that person can't possibly refuse so that they are being coerced. Well, in fact, this is exactly the opposite of coercion, because coercion is reducing the number of options until somebody is forced to choose the one the coercer wants them to choose. This is actually expanding the number of options. The original option of keeping your kidney is still there. You've just got an extra option, and if you take it, it means you regard it as better than keeping your kidney. And it's also an interesting corollary of this one, that if you're coercing the vendors by making them an unrefusable offer, you're probably treating them better if you offer them a great deal less money when then you start exploiting them. It's very interesting that offering a lot of money, which you would think was the best thing you could do in this circumstance, is regarded as a particular kind of cheating because it makes the person choose. Right. So those are the arguments about no true consent. Oh, going back to the competence one again, it seems pretty obvious that what's really underpinning the one that the vendors are non-competent is that there's a presumption that anybody who wanted to sell their organ couldn't possibly be competent because it's such an irrational thing to do. But again, whether it's rational to sell your organ depends on all kinds of things, like what you think the prognosis is and how badly you need the money. It could be perfectly rational to sell an organ. I bet everybody here has a price that they would sell an organ for, especially if they thought nobody else would ever know about it. You have to put that in to the thing, but most people would probably have a price for selling an organ. Anyway, going on from consent, there's a whole lot of other arguments. Right, now, when you've driven people into that corner, they then say, well, yes, we know all about this paternalism and autonomy and consent and the like, but the fact is, even if these people have genuinely consented, they've got it wrong. They really are ignorant, they're misjudging things, and we know this because we've got all these horror stories that come up from journalists and anti-transplant people all over the world. They're having a terrible time. They get cheated, they get lured by silly little things like portable radios and second-hand cars, or they're not paid the money, or they're treated in unhygienic clinics by unskilled people. And you get masses of these horror stories from around the world, which journalism is full of. Now, there are two questions here. well, there are several. One is, to what extent are these stories true? Because we all know that there are a great many urban myths about this kind of thing. Second question, to what extent are they representative? And I really don't know about that, because even if there are some pretty awful stories, there may be lots and lots of good outcomes as well. In fact, I once heard of a BBC team that went off to India with the intention of filming stories about how dreadful it was to have sold your kidney, and they found whole villages full of people who said, no, it's fine, it's, you know, life's been much better since we had the money. I honestly haven't a clue what the statistics actually are with this. But supposing significant numbers of them do get into a mess, the interesting question is why? Why have they got into this mess? Because we're now in a situation where surgeons are actually encouraging living donations. They think that nephrectomy is so safe that it's a thing that, you know, wife can be encouraged to do for a husband or whatever. And surgeons don't want people dying on the table. If they're willing to do it, it means that they think there's a pretty good prognosis for the donor. And interestingly, the thing about kidneys is that the single kidney you've got will expand to take over the function of the other one. So you aren't any less healthy, apart from the minimal danger of the operation and infection and that kind of thing. Afterwards, the single kidney is functioning enough for two. And furthermore, if you get kidney disease, you're going to get it in both kidneys, so you're no more likely to die of kidney disease from the one kidney. So the only way would be a freak accident that, you know, you'd be suffering from having only one kidney. So there's no real harm to it. There's very little risk of harm from losing a kidney. So if all these stories are true, the harm to the vendors has nothing to do with losing the organ. Has it anything to do with getting money? Well, no, because if you get money, you get something else that's good. So getting money for giving up an organ seems better than just giving up an organ on its own. So what is going wrong? Well, what's going wrong, of course, is that because kidney selling is prohibited now, everybody's forced into a black market, and the black market is paradigmatically something over which you have no control. Of course, the idea of making it prohibited is to stop it happening at all, but it won't stop it happening at all. Whenever people want something badly enough, they will find means to make the exchange. There are people who are dying and they're desperate to get hold of organs, even if they hated the idea of buying them beforehand. There are masses of people in the world who are desperate for money and who know you can live with one organ, with one kidney. So if there's anything wrong, it's the surrounding circumstances, and keeping it illegal is exactly what makes it impossible to impose on everybody, or everybody who's in the system, the kind of safety that you get with properly regulated organ donation now. So it seems to me that on the face of it, all these arguments are on the side of saying we ought to legalise it. Of course, it wouldn't mean that you didn't have a black market. There would always be a black market. And one of the problems in the Philippines, I believe, is that while some doctors are perfectly open and careful about all this, there are always brokers around who are doing things behind the scenes and offering people more money. And that's where a lot of the trouble comes from. But it seems to me that the worst situation possible is having only a black market where you leave people who are desperate at risk in this way. Of course, one thing people will say is, but you can't just legalise things in order to stop the harm. We aren't going to legalise the profession of hitmen just because if we legalise them, we could make sure all their victims were properly anaesthetised and suffered less. We don't do that. If something is intrinsically bad, intrinsically wrong, of course we're not going to legalise it. But nobody has yet shown in these arguments that kidney selling is wrong. The trouble is that the resistance to making it legal seems to be mainly fueled by the presumption that it is intrinsically wrong. How do I go back?
You can turn off the video.
Where's, oh. Ah. Oh, Res, well, here's another argument anyway. There's bound to be exploitation. Well, of course there's bound to be exploitation if it's an illegal market, and there might be even if it were a legal one. But again, you have to think of what the structure of exploitation is. Exploitation works when people are so badly off that they can be persuaded to do something by people who offer them very little, far more than they would have to offer people who were better off. Now, what this means is that if you are exploited, you have decided that taking the exploiter's offer is better for you than not taking it. So if you try to end exploitation just by removing the exploiter from the scene, then it's true you've thwarted the exploiter, but you haven't helped the exploited at all because you've removed the exploited's best option. The only way to help the exploited is, once again, it's like lifting out of poverty, to give them better options. So you can end exploitation by forcing the exploiter to give more, and in general giving the exploited better options, but you can't help the exploited just by removing the exploiter altogether. It's like saying you could cure ingrowing toenails by cutting off feet. You could, but you probably wouldn't. So that argument doesn't work either. They're all arguments for getting it organised properly. Here's another point of principle which is brought up. And again, we have two problems about it. It's wrong for the rich to have access for benefits unfairly to the poor. Well, that just means there's all inequality of wealth is wrong, and you might think that, but it's hardly a reason for stopping organ sales in particular. But in general, this applies to all private medicine. This applies to private medicine is most of the medicine in the world. If it's wrong for the rich to get hold of kidneys, isn't it equally wrong for them to get hold of all kinds of other treatments? Isn't it wrong for us as a country with an NHS to keep all this money for ourselves and not spreading it equally among the poor? Maybe this is a good idea, but it certainly doesn't selectively pick out kidney selling as a reason for objecting to it. And anyway, none of the people involved in this argument apply this to all contexts where things are necessary. But the other thing is, again, it doesn't rule out kidney selling, because several people involved in this debate have suggested that it isn't a good idea to have kidney selling a kind of private enterprise thing. Perhaps the NHS should be buying kidneys for equal distribution to everybody. Perhaps the World Health Organization should. The point is that the buying issue is quite separate from the distribution issue, and therefore you could allow kidney selling in a way which didn't contravene that principle, even if you did accept it. I've got to be quick, haven't I? Treating body parts like property. This one is quite common, and we don't allow slavery. Well, it seems to me that selling a bit of your own body is just about as unlike as possible somebody else selling you, the whole of you, into slavery. So it seems to me that this analogy is pretty far-fetched to start with. But the interesting thing here is we don't allow slavery. You're not allowed to give yourself into slavery either, but you are allowed to give your kidney. So in this particular case, if you're trying to say we shouldn't allow it at all, that's one thing, but you haven't yet given a particular reason for not allowing the selling as opposed to giving it altogether, because we don't give ourselves into slavery either. And I think there are all kinds of other issues about slavery which make it slightly different. Organ donation must be altruistic. This is one of the commonest. First question, why? Because there seems to be no other context in which we say that unless you can get someone to do something for you altruistically, you mustn't have it at all. We like it when people altruistically care for their elderly parents,
But if you happen to be an elderly person with no children or whose children aren't altruistic, we don't say you must suffer without care unless you can find someone to give you it altruistically. We don't say you mustn't have treatment for medicine unless the doctors will give their services for nothing. Why suddenly pick on this one as altruistic? And furthermore, in any ordinary meaning of the word altruistic, you once again don't get the entailment carrying through. Because think of that Turkish father again. If he had wanted to give his kidney direct to his daughter, everybody would have said, wonderful, an act of altruism. He wants to sell his kidney to buy something that his daughter needs just as desperately. That doesn't count. So in other words, to make it work, you would have to redefine it altruistic, specifically, as not involving money. And in that case, the whole argument would be question begging. And the same applies with the claim about human dignity. If you're going to persuade us that it's incompatible with human dignity to sell organs, then the very least you have to do is give an account of human dignity, which is separate from the selling, so that we can assess, first of all, whether we accept this view of human dignity and whether it leads to the conclusion that there shouldn't be organ selling. In fact, this argument seems to me to work only if you define organ selling as incompatible with human dignity, in which case the whole thing's question begging again. I've never seen anyone try to give an independent argument of that, except possibly a theological one, but then they get spilt over into the secular. There are better ways of getting transplant organs. This is like the lifting out of poverty argument. Of course there are better ways of getting transplant organs, but if those were working, we wouldn't need to prohibit selling organs because nobody would want to do it. Conversely, as long as there's any point in prohibiting it, we aren't getting enough by the other means. So that argument doesn't work either. There would be catastrophic consequences. Now, this leads into a totally different set of arguments, because most of the ones I've been talking about so far have been bringing in a principle which is supposed to override the concerns about saving life and autonomy and giving more options to the poor. Here, the argument switches. It's not that we have any objection of principle, it's just that dreadful things would happen if we allowed organ selling. Now, take your pick of the people who write about this, because they say, you know, concern for individuals would be slowly eroded and, you know, there would be decline and fall of civilization, and also there would be a great backlash and people would stop giving organs and so on. Now, there are various things about this. Obviously, these can't be coped with a priori. Philosophers can't just say, I don't think that's true. Well, they may, but the point is, if someone's making an empirical claim, which is supporting the conclusion that kidney selling should be prohibited, then it's just possible that it might be true and it might work. But I think here, people run into methodological difficulties of a different sort. Now, methodological points. So this isn't actually arguing against any particular claim. The commonest one now is that we'd actually lose organs because there'd be a backlash. First, if the burden of proof is on you, and the burden of proof is at the moment, I take it, on the person who's wanting to prohibit organ sales, you can't just talk about the probability of harm, the possibility of harm. You need actual evidence that it's likely to happen, at the very least. Now, this, I know we've got all kinds of experts here. This is not technically true, because what you're doing is a risk analysis, and only part of the risk analysis is the degree of evidence you've got for the thing that's going to happen. It also depends on how bad it is, and if it's bad enough, you might just say that you want and needed a small amount of evidence. But roughly speaking, that's true. But even if you have evidence of likely harm, what you normally do is try to devise ways of avoiding the harm rather than throwing out the good as well.
So if there are benefits to be got from selling organs, and you can see that there are ways in which things might go wrong, you do exactly what you do in any other area of commerce. You don't say, nobody can ever buy and sell because some people will get cheated. You say, let's have some rules in place to prevent the harm while we allow the good to go ahead. So methodologically, that's what people should be doing. And if they're not trying to do that, it rather implies they can't see that there's any good at all. And then just as a final point, because the amount of collateral harm is bound to vary with circumstances, it seems to me that it's almost inconceivable that anyone could think of an argument of this form against organ selling that would justify all prohibition at all times and all places. You might say there's good reason for prohibiting it now, but I can't see that there would be any argument that could justify it universally and all the time. Right, so where does that leave us? Well, here's the argument and this but. Well, this is really what's going on. Organ selling just is wrong. This is what's at the bottom of all this. This is the only reason these arguments seem to work, because unless you were convinced of that, you would immediately see the flaws in the other arguments. They aren't obscure flaws, which you need to be a logician to spot. They're ones which would cry out from the rooftops on them in any ordinary context. So, organ selling just is wrong. Maybe this is it. And a lot of people, when they're sufficiently pushed into a corner, do say this. They say, well, it just is a bedrock moral principle, and we have to accept it as such. And if anyone wants to say this is a bedrock moral principle, I'm not quite sure what arguments I've got against them. But it's pretty obvious that they don't believe that just because of all the justifications they give. They say organ selling is wrong because people aren't consenting, because they're coerced, because they're going to come to harm, because people are profiteering, because there's exploitation. If it were just wrong, you wouldn't have to do all that. You don't say killing people randomly and for fun is wrong because, and then start going into how it would upset the economy or something like that. It just is wrong. So most people actually can't really believe this, or they may just be giving the justifications for other people. But the other thing is, if you're going to put this as a bedrock moral principle, you've also got to accept that it's bedrock of a kind which overrides these other things which you normally regard as pretty strong moral principles. We should be saving lives, making things better for the badly off, allowing free exchange. So you not only have to say it's ground level moral principle, you have to say it's more important than these other things. And I've never yet found anybody who's willing to do that. Where does this go? Now, it leads to a very interesting question of why we have these intuitions that organ selling is a pretty horrible kind of thing. And I have them just as much as anybody else. Well, I suppose they're a bit weaker now I've been through all this, but I really don't like the idea a bit. And I've been trying to work out why. And this was, some of you know that all my electronics and data and everything were burgled just before Christmas, and this I had rather well developed in one of the bits that vanished. But I've been trying to remember it. I was trying to work out, if we look at what makes us think that some selling of the body is terrible, what are the relevant things that seem to determine how terrible it is? The stigma seems to vary with the degree of harm. That is, it's much less awful to sell hair, or to be a wet nurse, or even to be a sperm donor, which gets paid. It's something to do with degree of harm, whereas it's regarded as more serious if a woman sells her eggs. More serious, and interestingly, prostitution comes here. I think male prostitution has less of a stigma than female prostitution. And it's very interesting when you get prostitution into the political agenda and prostitutes start campaigning in public. Usually, the ones that do it are the ones who are rather successful and made a lot of money and tend to be dominatrices. That is, they're the least pressed down, I think, by the thing. So people feel they've made a good go of it, so they're
less harmed. I think the stigma varies with the degree of harm, but it seems to be more traditional, deep-rooted ideas of harm than current harms. The point is that traditionally, taking an organ out of someone's body was a terrible thing to do. It's only recently become something which can be done with relatively little harm. I also, this goes into another area where I think the really interesting speculations. It does seem to me that, going back into paying for sex again, there is a real harm to females in having to take on indiscriminate sexual partners in a way that there isn't for males. Just going back to the whole genetic business, because a female who has a child by an unsuitable man is saddled with having lost the whole of her genetic investment for that child, whereas a man who goes around impregnating arbitrary females can just have more offspring. So I think there's a huge sexual asymmetry here, which I suspect has something to do, this is all speculation at the moment, I suspect it has something to do with how strongly we feel about female prostitution. If you're sufficiently successful, it overrides the stigma. Now, that's interesting enough. I think if somebody got a large enough amount of money for their organ, or they sold their kidney and then did very well as a result of it, they invested the money well and educated their children and the like, I think they would completely lose their stigma in a way that you wouldn't if you had got your initial money dishonestly. That is, you wouldn't have to hide the origins. You would say you've succeeded. I suspect the stigma only comes with failure and being in a position where you need to. And then there's this interesting phenomenon, which is the essence of it all, that there's no stigma with giving rather than selling. And it seems to me that the most likely explanation of this is that if I give my kidney to somebody who needs it, nothing else will do. That is, this person needs a kidney. I've got a kidney, I can give them it. It will harm me in some ways, not very much now, but I'm willing to do it because it's the only thing I could give that would do the job. But if I'm in a situation where I have to sell my kidney, I'm doing it as a way of getting money, which is interchangeable with anything else. That is, it wouldn't have to be my kidney that I sold to get the money. I could do some other kind of work, I could do something else. If I'm actually driven to selling my kidney out of poverty, I think that's an indication that I'm right at the bottom of the heap. And I think that's true with the most despised forms of prostitution as well. So I think that's the trouble. I think the problem, the only thing I can find that fits the way our intuitions seem to work with this, is that it's indicative of a kind of degradation which puts you right at the bottom of the heap to be driven to doing this. And it's the same as being degraded by doing really unpleasant jobs which nobody else wants to do. So I don't think the issue is a moral one at all. I think the issue is one of degradation. And going back to the question of whether it should be prohibited, you don't help the degraded people by pushing them into a situation they regard as even worse. I suspect kidney selling will always be a low status thing to do, but it may be the best thing for some people to do. And at the moment, it's certainly doing a great deal of harm, and we can't control it until we make it legal. So there is the prima facie case.
Fantastic. And I'm glad to stand up.
I bet you are. Poor Julian. Julian needs a back if anyone's volunteered.